Welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Motha. Countersign is a podcast where we discuss books, films, and other materials. In this, its third series, we will focus on conversations that treat the problem of the environment, climate change, and mass extinction. You can catch up on previous series wherever you get your podcasts or on countersignisapodcast.com. Do you remember this guy and his antics?
Mr. Speaker,
this is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
The Treasurer knows the rule on crops.
It's coal. Mr. Speaker, those opposite have an ideological, pathological fear of coal. Affordable energy is what Australian businesses need to remain competitive.
It's Scott Morrison, the former Prime Minister of Australia, who, while he was Treasurer, took a lump of coal into Parliament to taunt the opposition. It epitomises the capture of governments by extractive industries and fossil fuel corporations, and features in Joel Bakken and Jennifer Abbott's film The New Corporation, the unfortunately necessary sequel. Joel Bakken has also authored a book, The New Corporation, How Good Corporations Are Bad for Democracy. The film and book are extremely timely as we experience the collapse of a climate and mass extinctions. They draw attention to how corporations have putatively remade themselves over the last 20 years by portraying themselves as socially responsible and elevating themselves above governments in relation to the delivery of essential social services and social goods such as water, education, and healthcare. Here's another clip that illustrates this point.
I'm not much of a believer in political citizenship. I actually believe much more in the power of the marketplace.
This is Richard Edelman, one of the world's most influential business gurus.
I think companies actually have filled a void left by government. Business is at the top rank. Government and media really are at the back end of the trust rank. These are big changes in reliability of business as potential good actor.
It's a brilliant strategy. They're going to present themselves as good actors and use that as part of their image and as part of their branding. When we see a big corporation doing something, it creates a sense of hope that maybe we can solve the climate crisis or inequality or other kinds of problems. We maybe even think of their huge power as being a plus because we know that the scale of these challenges are so big and we feel so powerless and frustrated about the ability of our government systems to actually solve them that we start to sort of put our faith in corporations. But of course, in the process of doing that, we're going further down the path that led us here.
As the opening clip of Scott Morrison taking a lump of coal into the Australian Parliament illustrates, fossil fuel companies have usurped governmental authority and power. Joel Bakken's book, The New Corporation, and the film tackle the urgent questions that arise from this usurpation of governmental power by corporations. The book was published in 2020 by Vintage, and the film is widely distributed in North America, but is yet to be more readily available in other parts of the world. In order to gain access or screening of the film, The New Corporation, please visit the website, thenewcorporation.movie, and there are details on how you can arrange screenings at your organizations or universities. More details are also available at countersignisapodcast.com. I discussed the film and book with Joel a short time ago, and we covered issues such as the psychopathic character of corporations, the need for greater regulation in controlling the excesses of corporate power, the potential of the rule of law, particularly as envisioned by E.P. Thompson and other Marxist thinkers, as well as the possibility and hope that mass movements and activists will put a stop to the rampant exploitation of people, plants, animals, and the environment by corporate power.
Joel Bakken, welcome to Countersign, and thank you so much for giving me your time. I was fascinated to watch the film, The New Corporation, as well as to read the book that it is based on. I wanted to begin by, you know, inviting you to tell us a little bit about the previous book and film, which had a huge impact, both in the legal academy, but much further afield. And I think that's a very significant aspect of your work. It was inquiring into what kind of a person the corporation is. And you've got this wonderful phrase in the new book, still crazy after all these years. And that reflects on one of the key theses of the previous book, that the corporation has the character of a psychopath. So I wondered if you could sort of begin by actually connecting the new film and book to your previous work.
Sure. And actually both of them connect to an even previous book to them, which was a book I wrote in 1997, which was a critique of rights, a kind of Marxian-inspired critique of rights on the Jewish question taken to the Charter of Rights and Freedoms in Canada. And the conclusion of that book was that the real constitution is in the legal infrastructure of capitalism, namely the laws of property, of contract, of corporations, and that if we really wanted to deal with using the Constitution to protect rights and promote justice, we needed to do work there. And so when I concluded that book, I realized I'd kind of written myself out of being a constitutional lawyer, without even realizing it, and that I really needed to go and investigate the economic constitution, the base, for lack of a better term, and how law constituted that. And I very quickly realized that the corporation was a really key part of all of that. As were the laws of property and contract and securities and other areas. But the actual legal constitution of the corporation became kind of interesting to me. And so I embarked on an academic project on that. And the psychopath idea was one that I had almost the first day of corporate law when I was a law student, because I had done psychology as an undergraduate and learned about psychopathy and sociopaths and all of that. And then in corporate law, I was learning that the fundamental principle of corporate law, well, there were two. One is that the corporation is treated as a person by the law, and the other is that it always has to act in its own best interest. And the penny dropped very quickly that, so we've legally constituted this person in a way that it always has to act in its own self-interest. Well, we would call that a psychopath if that were a human being. And so that idea had sort of been kicking around in my head since I had been in law school, and it became the central conceit of the film and book.
Getting down to the main argument, you take off from the fact that the DSM has now included seduction and charm to the definition of a psychopath. So that's convenient, because the corporation, and one of the key arguments in the film and book, The New Corporation, is that companies, corporations, have started to portray themselves and to project themselves as having intense social responsibility. And not only that, that they are the key drivers, and in fact, possibly in the case of some of the arguments put forward by CEOs, that they are better placed than governments to undertake a social role of coordination, provision of essential services, and so forth. So you have a set of arguments put forward by heads of corporations that they are a better place to govern us effectively. So that's the overall argument. And so let's sort of take off from there. I mean, what moved you at this particular moment to make that argument?
Yeah, well, this is one of those things that's like, you know, where were you when Kennedy was shot? That I actually remember the precise moment that I decided to do this project. And it was at a 10th anniversary party for the first film, a celebration. You know, we had champagne, we had appies, you know, we'd rented a big cinema.
Joe, we should say the first film was about 20 years ago.
Yes. So I can tell you the date, this was 2014.
Yeah.
Because the first film was released around 2004. Yeah. So this was 2014, which is almost 10 years ago now. And I was sitting in the theater and I was watching this celebratory screening and everybody was, wow, we did this great thing. We had lots of influence. The film did really well. It went all around the world, blah, blah, blah. And about halfway through the film, it just hit me like a ton of bricks that the first film was an abject failure, that every single thing that we looked at in that film had gotten worse. Climate change, colonialism, social, racial inequality, species extinction, labor abuses, human rights abuses, all of it was worse. And corporations were bigger and they were more powerful. And so there wasn't really much to celebrate if the measure is, did this film have an impact? The objective reality was things had only gotten worse. And in addition to that, corporations were now saying that they'd become better, so that there was this weird disjuncture. And not only were they saying they'd become better, but they actually, talking to corporate people, they would say, you know, thank you for making that film. You alerted us to a problem. Well, mm-hmm. we've now mm-hmm. solved it. Mm-hmm. Now we've baked, you know, social responsibility into our very core. It's no longer this peripheral thing. Now we're going to solve the world's problems, not create them. And so sitting in that theater, this sort of clash of thought, things are worse, corporations are worse, but they're saying they're better, suggested to me that a sequel was needed. Mm-hmm. And so that's really when I started to think about it, and to think that the sort of central idea would be that the psychopath had found its charm. Mm-hmm. And it was only sort of after having that insight that I discovered that the American Psychiatric Association had actually added charm and seduction to its list of diagnostic criteria for psychopathy. And so that helped too. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't just that it had found its charm, but that it was deploying its charm in the way that psychopaths do, which is to completely overtake and dominate its victim without its victim realizing that they're actually being dominated, thinking that they're being charmed. The victim, of course, being democracy and civil society. And so that idea kind of swirled around in my head. And then in terms of the kind of overall narrative aesthetic, I started to think about zombie films, because it struck me that this was a zombie story. This was a story about a town where everything is fine, and the opening scene is, you know, the paper boy and the white picket fences and throws the paper, and everybody seems really happy. But then it turns out that some of the happy townspeople are actually flesh-eating zombies. And so the first act of the film is depicting the happy world. And the second act is, uh-oh, we've realized they're flesh-eating zombies. And then the third act of the film is the townspeople. They're all gathered in the basement of the church. You know, half of them have been killed and maimed. And a few of them, the survivors, decide we're going to fight back against this thing. Mm-hmm. And they sort of rise up and they try to vanquish the zombies and take their town back. And whether they succeed or not remains an open question at the end of my film, and at the end of some zombie films.
Yeah. So going to the beginning of the film, the sort of white picket fence type scene, and an incredibly painterly scene that you create is through this extraordinary visit to Davos. I mean, I'd like to hear how you got in there with your cameras, but the scene is... at the J.P. Morgan reception, hosted by Jamie Dimon, the CEO, and he's brought along the former British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, almost like a prop, a smiling mannequin of his various, J.P. Morgan's devices. And there is Bebop Grester, who returns later on in the film as well, who's an aspiring startup CEO. Who is part of, or is one of the individuals who has the vision that actually corporations can solve the world's problems. So tell us a little bit about that scene.
Yeah, it's, Davos is a really important place for my story because it is the epicenter of the idea that corporations should be on an equal plane with government, not subjects of democratic governance. Its very motto of the World Economic Forum, which is who runs the Davos meeting, its motto is about public-private partnership. And when you unpack that idea, even just a little bit, a partnership is not about one partner exercising sovereignty over the other. It's about equal partners. And so along with that idea goes the idea that corporations therefore have to present themselves as publicly minded, as governing kinds of bodies rather than simply privately interested and in need of being governed. And so that whole package of ideas is very much what Klaus Schwab, who is the founder of the World Economic Forum and the host at Davos, it's what he's been saying and what his credo is and what he describes as the spirit of Davos for the last 50 years. He first came up with the idea of stakeholder capitalism in the early 1970s and is really the godfather of this whole new corporation idea. Now, in saying all this about Davos and Klaus Schwab, I want to distinguish myself from the right-wing conspiracy theories and theorists who look at Davos and the WEF and Klaus Schwab as sort of these, you know, dark room conspirators, smoky dark room who are trying to take over the world. That's not at all. And actually, when I decided to go to Davos, that wasn't even part of the scene. I was going there for the reasons I'm talking about, not to sort of denude some kind of global conspiracy. So I think there's another issue, which I can put in brackets here, which is the way that rigorous and legitimate and robust left-wing criticism has been very much negatively affected by the rise of conspiracy theories that sound like they're saying somewhat the same thing if you look at them only superficially. And I think that's a really interesting problem that needs some investigation. So going back to it, so I thought absolutely necessary to go to Davos for that reason, and also because it's a very efficient way to have access to these people and to talk to them. And to hear Jamie Dimon talking about Detroit, and to hear Richard Edelman talking about how he's not much of a believer in democracy anymore and believes in markets instead. And so it was just from a filmmaking perspective, these people are all in one place. I don't have to travel to 10 million different places to go and shoot them. So just from the economics of filmmaking, going to Davos made a whole ton of sense. In terms of how we got there, I mean, one of the things I've learned in making documentaries is there's no end to the potential of hubris to get to talk to people. Klaus Schwab came up with the idea of stakeholder capitalism. I'm going to reach out to him directly. So we fly to New York with the crew. We interview him. And again, it's hubris. He, like, why should he want to talk to us? But he does, because, you know, he wants to get his ideas out there. So we fly to New York. We do the interview. And at the end of the interview, I say, you know, it'd be really nice to be able to follow you in Davos to sort of see you in your ecosystem. And but we tried to, and they said no. And I said, look, you're the boss of this whole thing. Surely you can override that decision. So, oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, so fine. So you can come.
I mean, there is a really interesting fact that several of the CEOs really admire the first film. Yeah. I was kind of wondering about that, right? I mean, this is a, you know, this is a film that's highly critical of corporations. It's really challenging the very fact that they exist in this form with the lack of regulation and all of the harms that they do, etc. What do you attribute that to? Is it that they really sort of deeply believe that the new corporation is different to the corporation that you're characterizing in the first film?
You know, it's always difficult to know what people deeply believe. You know, as lawyers, we always talk about how in contract or tort or whatever, we always take an objective approach. We can't get into the actual minds of people. So we look at their behavior. And from their behavior and from the things they say and do, and from talking to them, I think they do deeply believe it, from what I can assess. When I was sitting across from Lord John Brown, the former CEO of British Petroleum, I did not doubt his sincerity. I doubted his sort of ability to see the world objectively, but I didn't doubt his sincerity at all. And I think that what people say, the people in the corporate world, is we got the message in the early 2000s, including your film. And they say that to me. They say, you know, you nailed it in the film. We'd been behaving badly. We'd been behaving psychopathically. You know, you're absolutely right. You diagnosed it correctly. And the cure is for us to become truly socially responsible. And that's what we're doing. And now they say that's what we've done. And to be honest, this is one of my regrets about the first film, is we actually laid the groundwork for that idea with our creating a hero out of the carpet tile manufacturer. He was featured in the film. He's a CEO. He's totally committed to sustainability. He's trying to make his company zero footprint, all of that. He sounds like an activist. He's, you know, just a great person. And he's pursuing this course of social responsibility in a very genuine, inspiring way. And so he was kind of created as a bit of a hero in the film. And I think that made it easy for people in the business world to look at the film and say, that's me. I see myself in that film as a hero for trying to make my company, you know, great and sustainable and all of that. And we didn't make that mistake in the second film.
Listening to you speak and also reflecting on the book and the film, I think one of the key insights that come out of it for me is the need for us to think about political responsibility rather than social responsibility. So the way in which the term the social is used itself, I think, is at stake. So let's sort of try to get there a bit more slowly. So one of the ways in which corporate CEOs and corporations appropriate this notion, very important, heavy notion of responsibility, is to say that they're now, you know, they've reformed themselves, they're taking into account worker safety. I mean, this is one of the points that Lord Brown is at pains to make, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, within a two or three years of him stepping down as CEO, the Deepwater Horizon disaster takes place in the Gulf of Mexico. 11 workers are killed, and it practically destroys the ecosystem in the Gulf of Mexico. So there is this sort of sense of being conscious of what people like CEOs are calling social responsibility. In fact, you know, just before I came online, I looked at the website of the Adani Corporation, which owns the Carmichael coal mine in northeastern Australia, or on the Exxon Corporation website. And they've all got very large, glossy, highly produced sections of their PR machine that talks about social responsibility. So I was wanting to ask whether this sense or notion of social responsibility has possibly as a concept reached its limit, and the site at which we encounter its limit is the fact that regulation has massively diminished. So in order to have what we call corporate social responsibility, you have to have a bonfire of regulation.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that social responsibility is a complete appropriation of the idea of the social. It's a ridiculous notion because there's, I mean, it's oxymoronic even, mm-hmm. I would say, from the start, because the idea of the social is intrinsically tied to the idea of democratic governance, however you want to define that, but that the social is the collective good of society, and the collective good of society has to be determined by the collectivity that is society, not decided in the upper echelons of corporate management. So we're handing over the very power to define or to decide what social signifies to these you know, unelected, unaccountable people who are running institutions that are legally required to serve their own self-interest. I mean, there couldn't be anything more bizarre behind the looking glass and oxymoronic than that. To take that idea a step further, the idea of appropriating the social is ultimately to destroy the social, is to eviscerate the social as a real and meaningful thing. And regulation is a good example of that. I mean, regulation, in theory at least, is the way that the collectivity enforces its wishes to ensure that it is not destroyed. It's the way that the social, it's a mechanism for the social to enforce its own good as it defines its good. That's what regulation is and should be. And yet the appropriated social becomes one that has no place for regulation, because not only is regulation not needed because the entity, the corporation, is itself capable of acting socially, so it doesn't need to be compelled to do that by law, but in fact, regulation gets in the way because it takes away the capacity of this better institution to better define what the social needs. We've seen the appropriation of the word social before. And I'm not in any way drawing a direct connection between corporate capitalism and the Nazi Party, but that is an appropriation of the word social, if there ever was one. This is a very different kind of appropriation, but it is an appropriation.
In terms of the stakes of this, particularly in ecological and environmental terms. One of the sort of fascinating accounts you give in the book in particular is the enthusiasm that corporations like Royal Dutch Shell, for example, one of the largest oil and gas producers in the world, had for the Paris Agreement on climate change. And in fact, the Paris Agreement has served as a sort of vehicle for corporations to greenwash themselves. And we see other symptoms of this. So when President Trump withdraws from the Paris Agreement, you have CEOs writing in to challenge this decision. So the sort of schemes that are put in place at a global multilateral level, at the level of the UN, also serve these objectives of so-called corporate social responsibility.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, and it's one of the stories in the book is the degree to which the corporate world has managed to partner with NGOs, including NGOs like the United Nations, and activist groups, and basically create dependency, in effect, on them in terms of direct funding and whatnot from the corporate, from the big corporations and from their organizations to these global governing types of bodies and non-governmental organizations. And it's tragic. And the Paris Agreement is a great example of that. You know, on the one hand, as people concerned about the environment, we have to, at some level, say, well, I guess it's better than nothing in the sense that it at least acknowledges the problem and sets some fluffy sort of ideas about how we need to move forward. And as progressive people, that then gives us a platform to fight for more. So I don't want to ever be cynical. There's a big difference between skepticism and cynicism. At the same time, on the other hand, the Paris Accord has absolutely no enforcement mechanisms, and none of the accords that have come after, including, you know, the most recent Glasgow, none of them have solved this. I mean, this is a document that has a lot of fine aspirations and no regulation in the way that regulation is typically understood, as providing a norm and providing a mechanism for enforcing it and providing penalties in the event that it's not complied with. We don't have that in any of these agreements. And that is because the oil and gas industry and other industries have been very effective in partnering, in lobbying, in PR campaigns around these moments where the world sort of comes together and tries to say, what are we going to do about climate change? Which makes this issue of this new understanding of corporations as our solution, as our saviors, as more the solution than the problem, it makes this issue, in my view, an existentially dangerous, destructive issue that not enough people are talking about, which is why I wrote the book and film. I think there's a lot of criticism about greenwashing and, oh, aren't these corporations hypocritical and blah, blah, blah. And I say, no, it's not that they're hypocritical. They're actually doing exactly what they're supposed to do. They are programmed to make as much money as they possibly can for their shareholders. And part of that strategically means that they have to convince other people to accept what they do in fulfilling that objective. And so they have to, you know, say we're socially responsible and sometimes actually be socially responsible. But what they're not being hypocritical. They're just doing what corporations are programmed to do. That whole critique, I think, misses the fundamental point of the problem. And that is that they're making a play for total power. They're making a play to diminish the democratic state to the point where it can't effectively control them anymore, and where they can basically, you know, mine the world for profits without any real constraint from democracy. And to me, that is a crisis that then will inevitably fuel other crises like climate, like poverty, like hunger, like pandemics even, because as we point out in the film, there are environmental factors that generate pandemics. So, you know, we're basically handing over governing authority to entities that simply lack the capacity to care about the public interest and that aren't accountable to the public that have that interest. So I have to say, in relation to that, it's frustrating to me as an author and filmmaker. The first project sort of took off, and you know, the book was a bestseller in the UK and Italy and many other places. This project hasn't taken off in the same way, and you know, there are various reasons why that may be, but just the fact itself is frustrating to me, because I think that the message in this moment of the new corporation project is far more important than the message of the first film and book were in the moment that they came out. This is a much more crucial project in the moment that we're currently in. It's identifying what I think is an aspect of our current world that doesn't seem to be part of a major discussion yet, I think is behind a lot of the crises that we face.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, sort of going back to touch on that very early point you made about talking about the corporation going to Davos, you know, this is not trying to find a sort of conspiracy theory type account, because what we see going on, in fact, has its roots in the 1980s. It's not just something that, you know, emanates from Switzerland. We've seen labor governments across the world adopt public-private initiatives. So the stakeholder capitalism is something that, you know, left, center-left and progressive democratic parties have had to adopt as a standard economic and governing policy in order to be electable. So the political stakes, I think you're absolutely right, the political stakes are extremely high in the current moment. And what's your sense of why this hasn't, this book and film hasn't caught on, you know, particularly at a time of, I mean, arguably the capacity for things to proliferate across the world with social media, et cetera, has increased in the last sort of 15 to 20 years.
I think what fundamentally is the problem with this project is that it goes after people who are widely perceived as the good guys. And the first project was easy. Big bad corporation, mm-hmm. we're going after you. Mm-hmm. This project is like, well, why do you have a problem? These people are trying to make things better. Mm-hmm. Like, what's your problem with that? And then if you say, well, they're trying to make things better because they're trying to take over the world, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. So it's like, and that's what gets back to what I was saying before, the kind of rise of conspiracy theories envelops within it legitimate critique. So I would say this doesn't go back to the 1980s. This goes back to the 1880s. Mm-hmm. I mean, this goes back to the rise of capitalism. Capitalism is about the creating processes, political, economic, social, that facilitate the accumulation of capital. That's why it's called capitalism. The telos is the creation of capital. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, you know, everything else becomes a means to that end. That is inherent in the word capitalism, that the end is creating capital and everything else is a means to that end. So people are a means to the end of creating capital, so you enslave them. Labor is a means to the end, so you exploit them. You take away the lands of indigenous peoples because you need to turn them into capital-creating things. Today, you do all of that, plus you take over water systems, take over education systems, privatize. You push for deregulation because it gets in the way of creating capital. All of that is aimed at doing away with fetters on the creation of capital. And we should expect nothing less in a system that's called capitalism. That's the telos. So that's where the problem starts. That is going to, that's not a conspiracy theory. That's a theory about structure. It's a theory about class. It's a theory about institutional dynamics that unfold as you would expect them to unfold when they're legally constituted the way they are. It's what, you know, we used to call in Marxism, an analysis. And an analysis is a very different thing than a conspiracy. But I think it's an analysis that in a world of social media, where everything sort of operates in 47 characters and 47 minutes on a YouTube video, and at a very superficial level, I think there isn't much room for analysis. This project is a long-form analysis. It is, you know, it's not superficial, and it's grounded in, it's a translation of what is effectively a class analysis of capitalism. And I guess that kind of thing is just not that popular these days for both political reasons and the media is the message reasons, that it's not an easy thing to convey on social media. It requires a certain commitment to try to follow a lot of dots and a lot of lines of reasoning. Or maybe it's just a crappy book and film.
Well, it's definitely not that. Now, like a lot of good Marxist analyses, I know you cite E.P. Thompson, and I'm going to quote the passage that you draw from Whigs and Hunters. And Thompson wrote, "Though law's operation has again and again fallen short of its own rhetoric of equity, the notion of the rule of law is itself an unqualified good." I want to refer to this in relation to the political moment that you so evocatively and articulately describe. Is the response, and no doubt part of the response has to be regulation, more regulation and restoring of a regulatory state. However, we're also in such a existentially dangerous moment where what's at stake in planetary terms, in ecological terms, is such that shutting down a road and intersection for a couple of days, blockading a world convention of international leaders on the weekend it's occurring, that just seems to be like political window dressing rather than political action. And so, for instance, Andreas Malm has argued in his How to Blow Up a Pipeline that there has to be a counter-violence, or there perhaps needs to be a counter-violence to the violence that has been inflicted on the planet and on most of its human population.
Well,
what's your sense of that in terms of the sort of the political moment that we're in?
Well, I think, as I argue, and to put it in those terms, I think the counter-violence is a violence against a certain set of ideas that are legitimating and justifying and making horror seem okay, to go back to the zombie film analog. You know, I'm not an advocate of violence, and it's not because, well, it's because I don't think violence is a good thing, but it's also because I read history as a set of failed attempts to use violence for good ends. You know, whether it's the Russian Revolution or many other attempts at uprooting, at revolution through violent means. And the reason why I think when you look at history, they are, you know, whether it's Maoism or Stalinism or even Leninism or Trotskyism, any of those, the reason why they ultimately fail, I think, is because they are in many ways the same kind of violence that authoritarians and corporations inflict on the world and its people. They are simply They're narrow. They're not aimed at people's imaginations. They're not aimed at people's sensibilities, at people's sense of what it means to be human, of what it means to love. But they're almost the easy way out. It's just, you know, we will capture the people currently in control, and we will install new people. But it doesn't change consciousness in any way. And there are obviously attempts to change consciousness in those revolutions. Sometimes, you know, and I think of the Cultural Revolution in China, sometimes ones that we don't at all feel are human, but they're done in the name of humanity, much like social responsibility is deployed by companies. So this is not the way forward, in my view. The way forward has to be through some kind of informational, educational consciousness, sense of humanity, or we're screwed. Now, we may be screwed because the timing of achieving that may not be possible. But violence is usually a symptom of impatience, and you know, legitimate impatience, because the project of actually creating the sinews of a collective sense of love and responsibility for one another seems a tall order. So ultimately, I, like E.P. Thompson, and I've gotten into the same kind of trouble with my friends on the left as E.P. Thompson got into with his, come back to this idea of the rule of law being an unqualified good. And I would add to it, I think that E.P. Thompson implies this, he doesn't develop it as much as he might, but I see the rule of law as simply an instrument of democracy. I mean, if it and a necessity in democracy, if we believe that democracy is an attempt for us as a collectivity to govern ourselves, that means that we have to have first a sense of what the substance of that is. What do we want to do? What is in our best interest as a collectivity? And second, we need a way to enforce that. And so if we decide what's in our best interest as a collectivity is not to burn up as a planet, then we need a way to enforce that. And the only way I can see to enforce that is through law. I don't see anything else out there. I don't think we can leave it to the good-heartedness of corporations. I don't think we can leave it to religious edicts. Law is the way we do it. We say, here's a rule. You cannot emit carbon any more than this amount, or you have to shut down your operation. And if you don't, you will suffer a penalty. And we will impose that penalty through processes that are transparent and that are evidentiary. We're not going to arbitrarily throw you in jail, but we're going to make sure that you, in fact, are committing this wrong, that the wrong is, in fact, the wrong that the collectivity has decided needs to be stopped, and that the penalty is proportionate to what you're doing to make sure to deter all of your fellow friends who are also doing it from doing it. You know, that seems to me to be the best that we've come up with. And maybe in some future society, 1,000 years from now, we'll have something else. But I can't really think that far ahead. And so I make this clear in the book, my endorsement of the rule of law is premised on the idea that the substance of the legal system is just, or the substance of the particular rules of law are just. Because, you know, if you're in Nazi Germany, you're not going to be an advocate for the rule of law. That's, you know, the legal system is fundamentally immoral and unjust. And so, you know, unless you're an advocate for some higher sense of law that says that legal system is immoral and unjust, that the legal system is undergirded by principles that are at some high level of abstraction about justice, and that our conception of how the legal system should imbue itself with substance has to be in accordance with those. And that those have to in turn be in accordance with some sense of the collective deciding what is in its best interests as a social.
That's a useful place for me to put this question, because the collective that you've mentioned several times now actually appears, I think, in the book under the moniker of the people.
Yeah.
So that's a very important idea, that there is a collectivity, the people who constitute the democratic order, and it's that order constituted by the people who legitimize the order that is fundamentally under threat when CEOs claim that corporations can effectively take over and do what governments do. But isn't the major crisis for the left the fragmentation of this people and the inability to form a consensus? In fact, Nicholas Rose, I think, made this point sometime in the mid-90s about the development, and again, this has been taken in very negative directions, but the sort of criticism of identity politics has been that it fragmented class consciousness and it prevented a consensus forming. There wasn't a common enemy because people were struggling with their own smaller communitarian battles, if you like. I mean, what's your sense about the absence of the collectivity that you're referring to?
Yes, I mean, and I think this is where consciousness becomes such a crucial factor in all of this, and where I think you know, violent revolution, to get back to the other point, is futile, let alone problematic in its own right. But the work that has to be done is in part in creating that collective consciousness. And, you know, I have two things to say about that. One is, that is why in the film and in the book, I advocate for a new kind of democracy, a more participatory, more open, more social kind of democracy, or democratic socialism, if you want to call it that. Related to that, I think there is a substantial grain of truth in identity politics. There is unquestionably a subordination of various identities that has gone along with imperialism, colonialism, the rise of capitalism, and every other ism, including religious orders. And we're seeing that now in some horrific ways in Iran, for example. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we hear a lot about intersectionality and the importance of understanding race in respect to gender and all of that, and in respect to sexuality and gender identity. And this is all very important, but what has gotten lost in all of it is class. And so, you know, I go back to William Du Bois, for example, the black sociologist in the mm-hmm. United States, who well under, or Cornel West today, who well understand the connections between class and race. Angela Davis in our film draws those connections, and we try to interpret and portray the fallout from George Floyd's brutal police murder as in part class rebellion. And that word is actually, that phrase mm-hmm. is actually used. Mm-hmm. And we have Cornel West and Angela Davis. And so I think what class does, and I argue this in my book, I argue that the fracturing of consensus is very much connected to the loss of the idea that democratic government should be providing the basics of survival and flourishing for people, whether that be education, whether it be food security, whether it be water, that we as a collective need to create that social baseline of enabling everybody to, if we're going to have a capitalist system, enabling everybody to flourish within it. Suffice it to say that what is needed is a strong social element in the sense of ensuring that the class relations of capitalism don't preclude people from living full and flourishing lives, regardless of where they happen to be. This is if we're going to have a capitalist system, a market system, then we need to ensure that the market system doesn't totally undermine that kind of social solidarity and equality. And then we need to build into that concern about intersectionality, to what extent, like socialist feminists do, or Black feminists, or, you know, we need to, or Black socialists, we need to figure out how certain identity groups are not getting served properly, are not equal by the putatively equal social measures that the state has taken. We need to be totally build those in, and those communities need to be absolutely involved as equal players in building those in. I mean, that's the kind of democracy that we need. A reason for not having consensus is that we've lost the sense that regardless of our different identities, we all have a common interest in having clean water. We all have a common interest in having a good education system where, regardless of our identities, regardless of our class, our children are properly educated, and we as adults can continue to educate ourselves, that we have culture that reflects all of our diversity and that is an important part of our lives, that politics are an important part of our lives, and that we feel not just a right, but a duty to be involved, and that there aren't barriers put in place on class or other identity lines to our participation, and on and on and on. But that's where the solidarity has broken down. That's where we've lost social solidarity. So I'm not suggesting we go back to the 1950s, but what was good about the 1950s is that the social inequality that we have today, the economic inequality, wasn't nearly as pronounced, and that we had taxes were very high for high earners and for corporations, and that money could be used for social programs and was through the 60s and 70s. And so that was the right direction. But the problem is that in the early 80s, the corporate world decided that that was eroding their potential profits too much. And so we have the rise of neoliberalism. And as I argue in the book and as the film argues, it's really that moment that fractures social solidarity in terms of our common interest in class terms, of having the means to flourish in our lives. And so what I advocate at the end of the book and film is a kind of democratic politics that that can do all of that, what I've just described. And I look at some examples of some people who are trying to do that. You know, obviously not perfectly in any way and not fully in any way, but who aspire to create that new kind of democratic politics, because I think that's our only direction.
Mm-hmm. We're running short of time, and I also want to ask you about your experience with Twitter. But another concept and that emerges in the context of retaking the political, which you sort of articulate towards the end of the book, is the notion of sovereignty. It appears several times, and of course why it's important is that corporations have effectively started to act like sovereigns. Indeed, they have far more power than many nation states in the world. So I can see why sovereignty is an important political idea at stake in this discussion. On the other hand, you know, I was born and grew up in Sri Lanka, part of the post-colonial world, which in my view partly ran aground because of the way in which nationalism informed political sovereignty. So post-colonial political independence across the world was heavily tainted by an ethnicized nationalism. And sovereignty is therefore an idea that I treat with caution because of that experience. I mean, what's your sense of the kind of thinking on sovereignty that we need going into this challenge of the current moment?
There are many ideas that are about power and governance that we need to handle with caution because they're equally capable of horrific ends as they are of good ends. And in a way, they're necessary for both. And we've touched on one of those already, which is rule of law. And sovereignty would be another related in that way, that these are both concepts that are designed to justify a governing body exercising power over others. And so in the abstract, concepts like sovereignty and rule of law, I think are very hard to assess because you can always raise examples and counterexamples. You know, whether it's the nationalism in Sri Lanka or it's the nationalism in Germany in the 1930s and 40s or it's American imperialism exercising its sovereignty, the sovereignty of the United States around the world by repressing regimes and so on and so on and so on. But at the same time, like the rule of law, I don't think you can enact democratic governance without sovereignty, in the sense that, again, you need to be able to govern. And so the question is, what are you governing in the name of? Are you governing in the name of a national identity and thereby repressing and destroying ethnic communities? Are you governing in the name of some ideal of democracy that is pluralistic, that is social, that is based on awareness of the class dynamics of a market economy, if that's what you're working with, and that seeks to ameliorate the harsh effects of that? You know, so it's very hard to either critique or celebrate a concept like sovereignty or like the rule of law or even like democracy without having or human rights or sustainability or any of these other things without having a concept of what they are instruments of, because they're all in some way instruments. They're not ends in themselves. We don't say that we want sovereignty because sovereignty is something we want. That would be what the current monarchist approach and defense would be in the United Kingdom, for example. But for progressive people, the question is always, how do these concepts, sovereignty, human rights, whatever, identity, how do these concepts, how can they be used in a way that serves humanity, that serves some humanistic sense of what the collective good is and some sense of the collective good that also doesn't destroy the earth that sustains us? And so I guess what I would say is, when we look at concepts like this, your question is how do we look at sovereignty? I would say when we look at concepts like sovereignty, like rule of law, even like markets, we need to think about them as means to ends rather than ends in themselves. And that's certainly not the end of the discussion, but it at least is a beginning of discussion of what their value is.
To move to the rather shocking treatment of this film and the trailer, as I understand it, which you tried to publicize on Twitter, and Twitter blocked the trailer. I gather that you're now, you know, involved in a in proceedings to challenge that. So I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, the long and short of it is that Twitter blocked our attempts to promote tweets that contain the trailer on the basis of the content of the trailer. And so the way that Twitter works is when you tweet something, it usually only gets out to a small percentage of your followers for a small percentage of time. So it's a fairly ineffective device, except to make you feel good that you've sent something out. But it's a fairly ineffective device unless you're Donald Trump and you have millions of followers. It's not a hugely influential thing to tweet. So if you want to gain more influence, if you want to reach more of your users and you want to reach people who aren't your users, Twitter has a system where you can promote a tweet by paying them. Mm-hmm. And needless to say, I mean, we were trying to promote the film. It was Oscar season. We'd been longlisted for an Oscar for Best Documentary, and we wanted to get on the shortlist. And those kind of campaigns are usually fought out on Twitter, let alone just getting word out so people would start watching the film, so we could do things like get a distribution deal in the United Kingdom, which we still don't have, and so on and so forth. And so we attempted to promote a tweet of the trailer, nothing more, just kind of saying, we've come out with this film, here's a trailer. And they said no. They said no. Six times they said no, because we kept going back and forth with them. And they raised three different reasons: that it's political content, that it's sensitive content, that it's inappropriate content. And they pointed to their policies and the user agreement that said that they wouldn't run that kind of stuff. And so we dropped a writ. We are suing them in the Superior Court of Ontario, which is the high court in Ontario, which is where Twitter Canada is based. Mm-hmm. And our hearings are set for December 12th, 13th, and 14th. And so I'm busily working with Sujit Chowdhury, who's my co-counsel on the case, a constitutional lawyer based in Toronto, and we're writing the factums and suing Twitter, and we're also suing the government of Canada for failing to regulate Twitter in a kind of positive rights claim under the Canadian Constitution. And we're fundraising for the lawsuit. We're not taking any money, but we have expenses like expert witnesses and things. And if people go to thenewcorporation.movie, they can follow the links. And if they want to contribute funds, we would welcome that.
Well, thanks. Thanks for telling us about that, and I'm very pleased to hear that Twitter is now going to have to confront E.P. Thompson.
In effect, that is what is happening. It's exactly right. We are deploying the rule of law and trying to hold them to it, and that's our very sort of liberal imminent critique. In the courtroom is to say to the judge, you know, this is about the rule of law. And the fact is that Twitter is currently not accountable in any way to the rule of law.
Well, Joel Bakken, I'm deeply grateful for your time. I learned a huge amount from reading your book and watching the film, and I found the conversation incredibly inspiring. So thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. I found the conversation inspiring and really great. So thank you.
Thanks, Joel.
You have been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.